You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 1st of April 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Tom Edwards. On today's programme...
I cannot confirm that Russia is withdrawing its troops, and this military build-up can in no way contribute to a de-escalation.
Jeffrey Kaufman and Samira Shackle will tell us what to make of Russia's behaviour regarding Ukraine, revelations on the CIA's interrogation techniques, and maybe April Fool's Day pranks in the media. Also ahead...
A great flood is coming. We build a vessel to hold the innocent.
Mama! What? Them!
We will look at the rise and demise and rise again of, appropriately enough, religious films with Karen Krzyzanowicz. All that, plus we'll check in with our man in Madrid, and we'll also review some nice summary tracks with Nick Luscombe. There might even be a bit of steel drum action in there. Oh yes. That's all coming up on Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. Plenty to enjoy then in the next 60 minutes. Before we get started, let's get the latest world news. Here's Paul Osborne.
NATO is to suspend all cooperation with Russia over the crisis in Ukraine. At the same time, a summit of foreign ministers in Brussels has agreed to increase cooperation with interim authorities in Kiev. NATO has warned Russia the progress in relations over the last 20 years could be lost because of its annexation of Crimea. And officials have said there is no evidence to support claims that Russia has withdrawn some of the troops who were massed on the Ukrainian border. Britain's Foreign Secretary William Hague was at today's meeting.
We have heard some statements or rumours from Russia about pulling back forces from the eastern border of Ukraine, but we haven't seen the evidence of that yet. Of course, we continue to call for that and continue to use every possible diplomatic means to seek a de-escalation of this crisis.
The CIA has repeatedly misled the US government over the severity of its interrogation methods, according to reports in the Washington Post. The newspaper has quoted a US Senate report, which says the organization kept elements of its operations secret for years and overstated the significance of terror plots. The report by the Senate Intelligence Committee says that harsh interrogation techniques often fail to produce any useful information. The CIA hasn't made any formal comment on those claims. The UN's refugee agency is warning thousands of Muslims could be slaughtered by Christian militias in the Central African Republic. It's trying to evacuate almost 20,000 from the capital, Bangui, and says 16,000 more have fled their homes in the last 10 days. The UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon is attending a conference on preventing genocide. He told delegates in Brussels that the crisis in the Central African Republic is precisely the kind of conflict needing international intervention.
The international community often proves reluctant to act, at times even when atrocity crimes are happening. There may be little appetite for new financial or military commitment, but is that sufficient reason to look away?
Two agencies have disagreed over the extent of an Ebola outbreak in West Africa. The charity Médecins Sans Frontières says it's spreading and proving difficult to control. But the World Health Organization has insisted it's not an epidemic and remains confined to a limited geographical area. 80 people have so far died in Guinea from Ebola, and 4 deaths have been confirmed in neighboring Liberia. The man leading the search for the missing Malaysia Airlines plane says it is the most difficult operation of its kind there's ever been. 20 ships and planes have again been scouring a huge area of the southern Indian Ocean without apparent success. Officials say the search area may have to be reassessed. China has said it's paying great attention to Japan's move to ease restrictions on weapons exports. It's the first major overhaul of the country's arms policy in almost half a century, an attempt to boost military ties with other nations and expand the country's defense industry. Britain's Prime Minister has ordered a review into the activities of the Muslim Brotherhood in the country. David Cameron says he's concerned by reports of possible links to violent extremism. Meanwhile, the parents of one of the Al Jazeera journalists held in a jail in Egypt on charges of assisting the Brotherhood have said they're refusing to give up hope. Peter Gresta was again refused bail on Monday alongside two other journalists. His father, Juris, says it's clear there's no real case against them.
There's a struggle to make a case. They've been incarcerated in maximum security for 3 months. They've had four court sessions now. And in all fairness, I don't think anybody could say that they've produced any kind of tangible evidence yet.
That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much indeed, Paul. Paul will return with the world news headlines for us at the bottom of the hour. Right now, with the time ticking towards exactly 6 minutes past 1800 hours here in London, you're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24, and we'll be back right after this.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Tu vai Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. Se on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Monocle 24 desu.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House. The time here in London is 18.06, 13.06 in New York City. Well, joining me now with their take on the news here in the studio, I'm delighted to welcome the veteran foreign correspondent, Canadian journalist Jeffrey Kaufman, and freelance journalist Samira Shackle. Welcome both to the programme. Great to have you with us as always here at Midori House.
Good day.
We'll start with the US and the Middle East peace process. Amid reports, the US may consider releasing Jonathan Pollard, an American jailed for spying for Israel back in the 80s, in order to save the Middle East peace process, or at least help to try and keep it on course. Jeffrey, I'll start with you. What do you make of this? Is this a classic piece of sort of functional business, trying to keep a process on track that looks worryingly like once again it's going to go off the rails? Or does it represent something different? What do you make of it?
You know, it's an imperfect world. It's a messy world. And sometimes you have to do things that you can argue intellectually and rationally you don't want to do. Pollard was arrested in 1985, as I recall. He has spent the last 29 years in jail for spying for Israel as a U.S. Navy specialist on American soil. And so in the eyes of the CIA and Americans, he is everything that the U.S. doesn't want to sanction, especially when you think of Bradley Manning and Snowden and WikiLeaks and all of that. Yet the U.S. needs to incentivize Israel. Israel thinks Pollard should be let go. Israel needs to be incentivized to release several hundred Palestinian prisoners in order to keep everything on track before the end of April deadline, in which all of these peace talks could just derail. So, you know, it's one of those things. Do you just hold your nose and do it? And I should add, by the way, that Pollard is up for parole next year. So while this was unthinkable when Clinton tried it in 99, it's a little bit easier to stomach today.
I mean, that's an interesting point, isn't it, Samira? We've probably been at crucial junctures in terms of the peace process before. Is it just sort of easier now, given that he perhaps might be paroled anyway in the not-too-distant future? Or do you think that does represent a measure, perhaps certainly of Kerry's or the Obama administration's determination to try and extend this process beyond the 29th of April?
I think there definitely is a determination, some would say desperation, to extend the peace process beyond the 29th of April. I think it's quite important to note that when this peace process was embarked upon last summer, the aim was to have a final agreement by the end of April. That's now been downgraded to just continuing talks after the end of April. And there's this sort of desperate bargaining is not for a peace deal. It's just to simply keep talking. So I think that's quite notable. And I think it's quite interesting what Jeffrey was saying about the way that Pollard is viewed by the US public. And I think that sort of really illustrates the high emotions around any kind of prisoner release. And that's sort of a reflection of what's been happening in Israel-Palestine. The current process has been stalled because Israel hasn't gone ahead with the final release of Palestinian prisoners that was agreed. And again, that's sort of it's such an emotional issue that for Palestinians, they're held as freedom fighters, the released prisoners, and for the Israeli public, it's horrendous to see these convicted criminals in many cases getting a hero's welcome. So I think it's an incredibly emotional issue all around.
But doesn't it feel, when you talk about Israel and Palestine, a bit like Groundhog Day? I mean, haven't we had these discussions, absolutely, different names, different circumstances, different years for, what, two decades? Mm-hmm. I mean, it is really staggering how stagnant all of this movement is. You know, I do remember as a young boy when Northern Ireland seemed to be in the same kind of quagmire. So maybe we can take some inspiration that Northern Ireland finally was resolved and when it seemed intractable. But boy, you know, you sometimes wonder, and I think it's legitimate to wonder, do these sides really want to make peace, or do they just want to be seen to be going through it? But, you know, there may be an incentive for them on both sides not to make peace and just to drag this on until the next president comes in. And there are more secretaries of state doing shuttle diplomacy.
Indeed. Well, talking about that shuttle diplomacy, it's interesting. I mean, Kerry he's certainly been racking up the air miles. He flew in to talk to both Netanyahu and the Palestinian negotiator Saeb Erekat for a few hours on Monday before jetting off again. What do you make of his efforts, Samira? I mean, is it just, as Jeffrey alluded to then, it's the latest in the long run of people for whom it's an equally fruitless task? Or do you think there's a different kind of level of determination? You mentioned it was almost desperation. Do you think it is? But how do you think Kerry will be judged, his sort of achievements or lack of them, perhaps, when we come to look back on this period and maybe in a few years' time?
I think there's no doubt that Kerry has huge personal commitment to the peace process and getting it back on track. And it was actually no small feat just getting the two parties around the table again. I think some would argue that his optimism was slightly overstated, and I'd probably agree with that. While I think you can't fault him for determination, for effort, for sort of having the kind of dedication and optimism about this process that was needed to kickstart it, I think that probably was slightly naive, and that sort of all the goodwill in the world, all the determination in the world can't actually get the kind of resolution that we need. And that's why I was sort of, as I said earlier, it's been so substantially downgraded from achieving a final deal till the end of April to scrabbling just to keep people talking. Mm.
Jeffrey, in terms of this sort of American view then, two things interest me about this. What's the view, do you think, of Pollard himself? Because was he slightly...
Gosh, I haven't talked to him.
Is he a forgotten man, though, in the US? Or is he still a resonant figure? You mentioned these other more recent examples that have obviously captured headlines much more recently. Do you think there's the same kind of collective... lack of will to allow
I think that time softens, and he's been in jail for 29 years, and as I say, he's up for parole next year. When Clinton tried to release him, George Tenet, the director of the CIA, threatened to resign at that time, and it was just
hard to see that sort of
that's not
level of response
today,
now.
And you actually have Henry Kissinger and others saying, you know, it's time. For Israel, this is a big deal. It's interesting. Israel initially disowned him when he was arrested in 85, but in 95, they made him an honorary Israeli citizen. So he will actually go to Israel should he be released. You know, again, this is just the messy reality of an imperfect world. And I think the U.S. needs to incentivize Israel. Israel's meant to release hundreds of prisoners. It's meant to freeze at least some of the settlements in the West Bank. And they're going, why should we do this? And, you know, obviously this is a bit of a carrot. The problem is you give them this carrot, and what do you get really in terms of moving this process forward except postponing the deadline?
Mm. A fairly grim perspective, perhaps unsurprisingly.
It's a tough one to resolve, isn't it?
Let's move on to some more grim details. The interrogation methods of the CIA, always another profitable ground to discuss. According to the Washington Post, the secret U.S. Senate report claims the CIA has repeatedly misled the U.S. government on the techniques it used, including, as we know, dunking suspects in water, hitting people's heads against walls. Very grim reading. I wonder, Samira, if I start with you, there's various sort of, you know, black sites that were used by the CIA under George W. Bush, we should point out. Do you think it's just safe to assume, therefore, that perhaps the CIA did mislead and continues probably to mislead the US government about various aspects of its business? Should we be unsurprised by that fact?
Yeah, I think it is unsurprising given sort of past things that have come out in dribs and drabs. Obviously, I haven't read the report, which is a secret document, but The CIA have argued that it's unfair, that it's biased, but I think those sorts of claims are par for the course. And I think there's no doubt really that these, not just that these practices took place, which are sort of disturbing enough in themselves, but the fact that that government was misled. And we've seen that, I think, also in Britain, that there's consistently claims that these methods are justified because of the type of intelligence they gain.
You have to see this in the context of the times. I was amongst that very first group of reporters at Guantanamo Bay in January of 2002 when they reopened that mothballed naval base in eastern Cuba. And we watched these shackled prisoners come off a U.S. military plane in their orange jumpsuits with their arms and legs bound and their eyes blindfolded. And, you know, Donald Rumsfeld said we were watching the worst of the worst. Time has shown us that some were bad apples, but others were just in the wrong place at the wrong time. You know, I think what this report shows us is what many of us at the time suspected, and yet it was very hard to articulate or to prove, which was that the kind of jingoism, the insecurity, the trauma that followed 9/11 led to this "how dare you question us" attitude that so pervaded the media in the U.S. and was really the cheering section was really Fox News, but really I think all mainstream media were complicit and really afraid of challenging the status quo. And of course, you know, how do you prove that these kind of waterboarding techniques are going on? And you know, what's important in this report, the Washington Post is the one that got a hold of it and has done an excellent job today. What they're saying is that the CIA simply lied about the results they got from these very harsh really brutal, just unthinkably brutal techniques.
I mean, it's worth sort of revisiting some of the detail of this, because there's suggestions from this report, according to the Washington Post, that certain suspects, including alleged members of Al-Qaeda, had yielded all the information that proved to
be
useful before. I mean, there's examples of individuals waterboarded over 80 times. I mean, levels of brutality that are almost unimaginable. Do we come to a point where we say, regardless of the value of the information,
but it's not regardless. I mean, that, you know, I don't think we need to go to that level, because this report definitively says they lied about what they got. You know, the individual you're talking about it's a form of waterboarding. They actually dunked his head in cold water. Waterboarding is a slightly different technique, when they put a cloth over your face and pour water and you feel like you're going to drown. But in this case, they said that he yielded his information as a result of his 83 being submersed in cold water and feeling like he was going to drown 83 times. In fact, what this report says is that all that he gave was given before then. He was already cooperating, and that it was not necessary. I mean, what you get is a picture of some very sadistic men who were saying, "Let's just push him." And this is the kind of thing you would expect out of Soviet Russia or Eastern Europe or North Korea.
So do you think we should have expected to see more divisions than within the CIA itself? There's allusions to that in aspects of this report.
You did, yeah.
You
did see these in Thailand, a group of CIA officers actually left the black site because they were so disgusted by it.
I mean, are you surprised, Samir, that perhaps that didn't happen in a more, I mean, hard to say, public way in this clandestine world, but we're surprised that there's not suggestions of greater divisions within the CIA, given not only these questions, but others were especially, you know, asked in others of these black site centres in other theatres around the world, in Pakistan, in the east of Asia, for example.
I think Jeffrey's right to point out that it's a sign of the times, and I think when it's something has been set up as this sort of enormous evil that needs to be fought at all costs, and it becomes a sort of battle of ideas of one civilization against another, many things become justified. And also, we know that it sort of ingrained into the fabric of any intelligence organization is a sort of dedication to national security, a belief that what you're doing is ultimately furthering national security. So I have no doubt that individual CIA agents might have felt doubt about it and sort of powered on anyway. I think that there really has to be a focus on sort of getting this in line, because you just can't. It's the fact that not only is it sort of such undeniable brutality, but the fact that it wasn't even useful, you have to sort of question where that leaves you as a nation, as a security agency.
I think that, you know, we've talked about this in other contexts around this table before. I mean, one of the most difficult things in a Western democracy is to police your secret police. And you know, there is so much of this, well, we can't talk about it. And, you know, you say, why didn't it come out? Well, you know, you'd have to abandon, you know, you'd have to jump ship. And, you know, imagine in 2003 or 2004 or 2005, leaving the CIA and going public to the New York Times or ABC News and saying, you know, this is what's going on. I mean, you would have been massacred.
Well, it's unthinkable, isn't it?
It is unthinkable. Yeah. I mean, I was living in the U.S. and I was reporting, you know, both domestically and overseas at that point. And it was such a climate of, if you're not with us, you're against us, that it was just impossible. And, you know, I think that in time this is going to be looked at. This is the darkest era of the CIA, and it's very much another McCarthy era in U.S. history.
Well, strong words indeed. Just briefly then on the CIA and where it stands now, we've also had this alleged snooping of Senate computers fairly recently, Dianne Feinstein saying it undermines the whole constitutional framework of the U.S. Where do you think the CIA is sort of at as an institution? Is it still racked with these kind of problems? What do you think, Samira? Is Jeffrey right? Was this almost a kind of neo-McCarthyist era? Is it something as bad as that? How will history judge the CIA? And certainly, I guess, in the post 2001 performance.
No, I don't think it's going to judge it kindly. I mean, if you think that sort of the US is ostensibly dedicated to principles of democracy, of human rights, of justice, and those have been completely thrown out of the window, not even a nod to them as soon as 2001 struck. You know, it's just completely hypocritical, I think, given the sorts of values which are supposedly spread abroad. And I don't think there really is any justification, particularly. But, you know, I think it's also, we shouldn't think that it's completely in the past. I think a lot of these policies are continuing.
Although I think it's important to draw a line in 2009 when Obama took office, because Obama banned a lot of these techniques and really did change direction. So I think that it, you know, you have to sort of look at the period between 9/11 and the end of the George W. Bush administration as one period and the current one as another.
And what about that Guantanamo, though, the failure to close that? I mean, a lot of people suggested that the era can't end until that happened. Yeah. Will that be a sort of a black mark that endures, do you think?
I think it shows the kind of divisions within Congress that, you know, and the limits of power of a president, particularly a Democratic president, who comes up against this hardline Republican view.
That's Jeffrey Kaufman. Samira Shackelstiel with us as well. We'll take a short break. When we come back, we'll discuss Russia's behaviour in the Ukraine. Stay with us.
If you're after a soundtrack to your working day, look no further than Monocle 24's Globally Minded playlist. We play the very best upbeat music from around the world, around the clock. Whether that's jazz from Japan, pop from Paris, house from Hamburg, or soul from Seoul. It's all picked by our team and presented by our editors. So get lost in music with Monocle 24's playlist right here, day and night, on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Still with me is Jeffrey Kaufman and Samira Shackle. Let's continue with Russia and Ukraine. NATO chief Anders Fogh Rasmussen said today there's no sign of Russian troops being pulled away from the border. This despite Russian President Putin having told German Chancellor Angela Merkel that he had ordered a partial withdrawal of the troops. Samira, no withdrawal, as was supposedly promised. Should we be surprised in the slightest?
I think probably not. The anxiety is that Russia is not going to be satisfied with the annexation of Crimea, that it's going to continue into the rest of Ukraine, perhaps into other nearby states with large Russian-speaking minorities. They've said that the troops that are on the border are there for drills. I think the worry in NATO is that there doesn't seem to be very much drilling going on, just sort of deployment and waiting. There's sort of a question mark over how much NATO can or should be doing, I think. There's a sort of school of thought that says the reason this has happened in the first place, that Russia feels warranted in this aggression, is because NATO didn't respond harshly enough after Russia's aggression in Georgia in 2008, that at the beginning of this crisis, not enough was done. But I think, on the other hand, there isn't much appetite for an all-out military confrontation in Europe. And so I think it sort of leaves NATO in quite a strange position. There's lots of this sort of fighting talk about strengthening air forces and naval forces. But then even the rhetoric is sort of tempered, saying, but we don't actually want to fight. So it's sort of it's a strange thing. Sort of all they seem to be left with is sort of flexing of muscles with military drills in the region. So I don't know quite whether that falls down on one side or the other.
Jeff, what do you make of NATO? They've got obviously a new leadership coming in October, of course. This was surely the very sort of incident they were supposed to be the peacemaker, the broker, to prevent. Are they
in effect? Well, that's not really their role. Their role is to defend the 28 member states. You know, we are one, and Ukraine is not one.
This is true, but I mean, people already should, you know, Latvians, for example, or others, fearing that they're not.
They are NATO.
That they won't be protected, though.
They are NATO. Latvia and Estonia.
So do you think their fears are unfounded?
Well, I think Putin's no fool. He knows what NATO is. He knows that Crimea, ultimately, while it matters to Ukraine, is not important on the geopolitical map in the way that the Baltic states are. I mean, Finland is actually a country to look at. Finland has avoided joining NATO and has got to be, we're hearing that they are jittery and they're thinking, gee, maybe we should. Maybe we do actually need the NATO umbrella around us. That's a discussion. But I think Samira's right. You know, there's just a lot of beating of chests and rhetoric, but ultimately the world has no appetite. And what would you really do? I mean, you're going to drop a nuclear bomb. It's an incredibly humiliating experience, not just for President Obama, but for the entire West. And I think that, what that sound coming out of the Kremlin is laughter as they clink glasses of vodka and go, well, comrade, look what we've done. You know, the good old days of the Soviet Union have been resurrected. I do think, though, that one of the things you have to remember when you look at the context of this invasion of Crimea and the annexation, is that Russians have every right to be a proud people, and as NATO moved east and took over the Warsaw Pact countries and the Baltic states, this was a kind of erosion of the former Soviet and now Russian sense of self, and so this is in many ways a kind of a lashing out over that. And Crimea is very far from Western Europe. And so in many ways, it was one of the easiest and in many ways, historically, the most logical, because the Soviet Black Fleet is there. It was part of Russia until 1954. But in that context, you can understand it. It doesn't mean that you can excuse it or that in the modern world we want to see it allowed, but there is a context to it.
Absolutely. Let's finish the programme with something a little lighter. It's the 1st of April. That won't have escaped any of our listeners' attention, which means you must approach your newspaper with an even healthier degree of suspicion than perhaps you might ordinarily, because there are a number of stories which are April Fool's stories. I always rather enjoy this, and that's because I'm a newspaper man, but it's always something of fun to spot the particular stories, the concocted tales. We've had, the UK government trying to ban selfies, the Huffington Post suggesting that Piers Morgan was going to become a social media advisor to the Liberal Democrats. What do you make of this, Mary? Is it a bit of good fun? Do you enjoy the sort of leg pulling of the 1st of April, or do you think it's a bit of nonsense and the newspaper should get on with doing some proper journalism?
No, I do like it. I think it's quite nice. It was I find it quite funny that the difference that now I think that sort of the joke stories are outed on Twitter within about half an hour. But it was quite funny, I thought, today, because last week I was having a conversation with someone about the Eurostar, and someone very seriously told me that when they were building it, the UK and France had been building from different sides and sort of very nearly missed each other in the middle of the Channel Tunnel. And today I found out that was April Fool's Day prank from about 10 years
classic
ago.
Classic April Fool's prank. What about you, Jeff? You're a serious newsman.
I've been
news
working
man.
Today. Are you going to make me actually...
you're a serious newsman. I wonder, do you think, is it too much froth and frivolity, or do you think there's always a space for a bit of fun and a few laughs on the way?
Listen, we're all allowed to laugh. I mean, my problem is that today... funny and cute are so packaged. I look at Facebook and I see sites like Upworthy, and I actually just, I have to block them now because there's too much of that going on, and it's all so contrived. I mean, April Fools had a certain innocence. Now it's become, it's like it's one of those things that people have to scheme and plan. And, some of it's good fun. It's fine. Let's laugh. I mean, no journalist who understands media would suggest that every story has to be about the most serious things.
Absolutely. And any just in your... any
square of, eggs and any, things like
any
that.
Any favourite square eggs?
The Evening Standard. You know, there is this strange habit now here in London to call the buildings in the financial district, in the city, as it's called, strange names, the cheese grater, the walkie-talkie. So the Evening Standard had a picture of a new building called, I think it's the Toast, and it's shaped like a piece of toast.
What could be better than that? Jeffrey Kaufman and Samira Shackle, thank you both very much indeed.
With butter, please.
For joining us here on Midori House.
vanuit Londen. Dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
Uit London, dit is Monocle 24.
Fra London, dit is Monocle 24.
From London, desde Londres.
Holanda.
London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
Plenty still to come then in the second half of today's Midori House. We'll review some cracking tunes with Nick Lusk and we'll check in with our man in Madrid and we'll find out why Hollywood has once again discovered the Bible. Before all of that though, let's get the latest world news headlines. Here's Paul Osborne.
NATO has announced it's to suspend all military and civilian cooperation with Russia because of the crisis in Ukraine. At the same time, a summit of foreign ministers in Brussels agreed to increase cooperation with interim authorities in Kiev. NATO warned Russia that the progress made in relations over the last 20 years was now at risk. The CIA has repeatedly misled the US government over the severity of its interrogation methods, according to reports in the Washington Post. It's quoted a US Senate report running to 6,000 pages, which says the organization kept elements of its operations secret for years under George W. Bush's administration. The UN's refugee agencies warned thousands of Muslims are at risk of being slaughtered by Christian militias in the Central African Republic. It's trying to arrange the evacuation of almost 20,000 from the capital Bangui and says another 16,000 have fled their homes in the last 10 days. Two agencies are disagreeing over the extent of an Ebola outbreak in West Africa. The charity Médecins Sans Frontières says the outbreak in Guinea is spreading and proving difficult to control. But the World Health Organization insists it's not an epidemic and so far is confined to a limited area, though 80 people have so far died. And the man leading the search for the missing Malaysia Airlines plane has said it's the most difficult operation of its kind there's ever been. 20 ships and planes have again been scouring a huge area of the southern Indian Ocean without apparent success. And those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much indeed, Paul Osborne. And Paul will return with a full bulletin of world news for you at the top of the hour. That's 1900 here in London. Right now, though, you're listening to Midori House live here on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards. And it's time next in the programme to check in with one of our correspondents somewhere in the world. Today, we're heading to Madrid. Our correspondent there is Liam Aldous, and he joins me now on the line. Liam, a very good day to you. I hope you're well. Thanks for joining us on the programme. Where should we begin? Let's talk about, well, a good news story. This a Spanish journalist whose fate, I guess, a lot of people were studying. Finally, a bit of good news. Tell us more.
Yeah, so it has been. There's been quite a few scenes of jubilation in Spain because two journalists, in fact, one from El Mundo and another photographer, who have been held in captivity in Syria by insurgents for 6 months, finally returned home. And it's been a long ordeal. Their story has been in the papers for a very long time. And they stepped off the plane. And I have to say, the pictures were quite shocking because I've got used to the picture of their faces in the news for the last 6 months. And they were so gaunt and so thin, but they seemed to be in quite good spirits, and their family was obviously overjoyed to see them.
That is a good news story. What's the coverage been like there, Liam? Because there's been a number of journalists, aren't there, who've been held in Syria, all around the world. We sort of chart the progress of various campaigns for release. How's the movement been working in Spain? Is there a feeling that this is the fruits of a really intense effort to try and get these people back?
Yeah, it's been a very difficult effort, as you say. But obviously, the coverage as well of the Syrian conflict has been hindered by the fact that not only these two journalists, but another journalist was also captured in October. But he was released earlier. He was released just in the beginning of March. So we've had the return of three journalists, and it's quite good because there's still about 30 journalists in captivity in Syria, and there's about 25. Reporters have been killed since the conflict began, so it's obviously it's not a very easy job. And I don't think after what's happened to these three journalists, there'll be many other Spanish journalists wanting to go back onto the battlefield.
No, understandably so, perhaps. Let's talk about, from newspapers to the world of publishing, a new book. It's going to be released this week. Tell us about this, because there's some pretty controversial claims. Detail, if you will, for us, Liam, exactly who this involves.
It's a doozy, if you will. It's a bit of a scoop that still hasn't been really treated with enough seriousness in the press, because a lot, the book is, as you said, released on Thursday, and there was an abstract released in the El Mundo newspaper. The book itself, I'll get straight to the point, the book itself is written by Pilar Urbano, and it basically alleges that the King of Spain was the real force behind the failed coup attempt in 1981. And this is a bit of a bombshell, because the king has always been presented as the main propeller of democracy. He was the one that led the transition into democracy and really helped Spain move into a peaceful future. And the fact that she's alleging, and she's not just anyone, she's not this kind of renegade journalist, she's actually one of the main biographers of the royal family. She's written a lot of books about the queen and the royal family, and she's used her conversations with Adolfo Suarez, the ex Prime Minister who actually led the transition as well, who died just last week, according to conversations she had with him and a lot of other people. She's alleging some pretty serious stuff, and it's quite interesting.
Interesting indeed, Liam. And I suppose the whole coverage of this incident and of the royal house is all very, it's all rather intriguing, isn't it? Because we've seen other efforts by perhaps a journalist, a writer at the other end of the experience scale, if you like, who'd made up a sort of a fake account of what had happened during this failed coup attempt, and that landed them in trouble.
Well, he got into trouble just because it sparked a very kind of a very important debate in Spain. The journalist you speak of was Jordi Evole, who has a very high-rating documentary or investigative journalism show on Sunday nights, and he gets access to all of the leading figures in Spain. And he actually concocted a show basically telling the real story of the 23rd of February. It's called 23F, which is the coup d'etat, the failed coup d'etat. And at the end of the show, he used interviews with leading politicians, people that were there, and at the end of the show basically revealed that it was all fake. And the point of the show was to show that because of secrecy laws, which basically stipulate that no one can tell the truth until 50 years after the event. 50 years is a long time. And he said basically, we would have liked to tell the real story, but the laws prevent us from doing so. And then led on to a debate with some other political figures talking about the role of the king and all this secrecy and why Spain isn't as transparent as other countries. So it's a very hot topic, and I'm sure on Thursday when the book is released, there'll be a lot more allegations and a lot more headlines.
Well, we'll watch this space for that one, Liam. Perhaps we'll speak to you again later in the week to find out more. Let's move on and talk a little bit about the funeral in the last day or so. Adolfo Suarez, tell us about this.
Yeah, I was just, like I said, I was just talking to him. He was the first prime minister that was a very unifying figure. He really tried to get everyone together and put Spain onto the path of democracy. And yet he died last week. His funeral was held yesterday and was in a stark contrast from the scenes that we saw in his memorial service just after his death, where a lot of prime ministers and political figures came together in an act of unity. His funeral was a little bit different because all the prime ministers were still there, but there were quite a few politically loaded statements by the Archbishop himself, who actually asked everyone to pray for Adolfo Suarez, but also pray for Spain, that efforts need to be made so that Spain doesn't engage or get bogged down into more conflict that could lead to a civil war. He made some very pointed comments to Artur Mas, the regional premier of Catalonia, who was sitting in the front row, and said that people like Adolfo Suarez really had the interest of Spain and its unity in heart, and was looking straight at Artur Mas. And then the other elephant in the room was Teodoro Obiang, who's the dictator of Equatorial Guinea, who was the only head of state to actually turn up to the funeral, which is kind of it's kind of bad, because Adolfo Suarez was the great democrat, and here you have a dictator in the audience at his funeral.
Indeed. Liam Aldous, our correspondent in Madrid, thank you very much for joining us here on Midori House and bringing us up to speed with all the big stories on your beat. Up next, we're talking movies. We're talking a little bit about the resurgence of the religious film. Stay tuned to find out more on this episode of Midori House, right here on Monocle 24.
If you thought Vancouver fashion was just about open-toed sandals and fleeces, think again. Local clothing brands are on the rise, giving the city a stylish boost. Monocle Films headed to the West Coast to meet forward-thinking retailers.
We first opened this location in Chinatown in 2011, and it was really new at that time. There wasn't too much really going on in the neighborhood. We're pretty much one of the only ones on the block. But since then, it has grown quite a bit. It's become a really great little, kind of like if you know, then you know kind of places.
Fashion City, Vancouver. Now playing in the film section on Monocle.com.
Welcome back to Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. Now, Hollywood is a place that seems to get very excited about one particular thing at a time. We have remakes of old classics, then a boom in 3D films. Now it seems that they're looking to the Bible for inspiration. Indeed, the American film industry hasn't perhaps experienced this kind of flood of religious films for a number of decades, not since Ben-Hur and the Ten Commandments. Maybe it was all started this time around by Mel Gibson's movie, The Passion of the Christ, over 10 years ago. 20th Century Fox have a high-grossing film about Jesus, Son of God, which is doing great guns. And Darren Aronofsky released his film Noah this last week, and more's to come. Spielberg's looking at one. We've got Exodus, Ridley Scott movie with Christian Bale apparently in the pipeline as well. Well, what is with the appeal of the Bible to the contemporary cinema audiences? Joining me now to explain why is Monocle's movie expert, Karen Krasanovich. Karen, welcome back.
Oh, thank you.
To the programme. First of all, is the whole premise right or wrong here? Are we now in an era of unprecedented biblical movies, or are we actually wrong if you look at the numbers?
Well, comparatively speaking, we are. It is a new dawning, a genesis, if you like.
I like what you've done there.
Thank you. Statistically, this is nothing new. In fact, Hollywood used to get around, you know, the Hays Code, which was about censorship and what you could and could not do in early Hollywood. They would have biblical epics so they could show a lot of sex and violence. And then in the last reel, you know, there would be repentance and a moral issue. A moral resolution. What am I looking for? I'm looking for a moral lesson. That's the word I'm looking for, a phrase. But actually, if you look at films based on the Bible, by my rough count, there were 25 that were done in the 1950s, 20 in the 60s, 19 in the 70s. 70s started sloping off. 18 in the 1980s, 31 in the 1990s. You'll notice a trend here. And 46 in the 2000s.
Wow.
So this is something that is not only has to do with religion. It actually has more to do with the box office.
As so often the case, the cynics perhaps might say. But what do you think in terms of the current crop of movies then? I know you've seen some of them. Noah, which is probably the sort of most high profile of the recent releases. Have they changed in terms of what people are trying, the aspects they're trying to bring to the screen? Has the impact of, I mentioned Mel Gibson's Passion of the Christ, going right back maybe to Scorsese with The Last Temptation of Christ, have they changed not just the appetites, but the way that these stories are told on the screen, do you think?
Oh, well, Noah has certainly changed the stories, because we were talking about, for example, Noah saying, well, repopulate the earth. Well, sorry, it's just your family. So how does he get around the incest? And he does that by bringing on the Emma Watson character. So there is a lot of redressing. There's also, for example, I think it was The Last Temptation of the Christ had sexual dreams, which you don't usually attribute to Jesus Christ. And also there's the flagellation in Mel Gibson's Passion of the Christ, which, so these things are there, but they're emphasized. It's like in a script, you might see a battle, you know, there's a limited battle ensues, and that could be 40 minutes of filmmaking. So there's a change in emphasis, but primarily, this is an untapped audience, untapped by mainstream Hollywood, that is. But there is a thriving religious filmmaking, a civilization, I suppose, all throughout America and in other countries.
And that's interesting, isn't it? Because I guess a lot of mainstream moviegoers are used to some pretty basic, almost caricature appearances of religion in films, be it the sort of, you know, the sort of ultra-conservative father who disapproves of the rebellious teenager. Do you think that there's a feeling that people are actually a little bored with those kind of depictions, and they'd almost rather go back to the good book itself to see what the religion is supposedly really about? Or is that too sort of complex a reading of this?
No, I don't think so at all. And I think Fran Lebowitz was saying that a lot of studios think that that people who are religious, who go to the cinema, are going to be only interested in strictly biblical stories. They're not. They understand that a living religion is as complex as everyday life. And these kind of stereotypes, nobody really enjoys stereotypes. I don't even think in games people enjoy stereotypes. So we want a more sophisticated a story that speaks to our life. Now, whether that's religious or not, Hollywood is actually trying to make a new market for itself. It's trying to touch, just kind of like that beer that reaches places that other beers don't reach. That's what Hollywood's trying to do.
I like that analogy very much. Let's take a little bit of a listen to Noah, then, one of these recent incarnations. This is the Darren Aronofsky picture, of course. Let's hear a little bit about what will greet people who go to the cinema to watch this one.
Can I not be averted? Man corrupted this world and filled it with violence. So we must be destroyed.
A great flood is coming. You build a vessel to hold the innocent.
Mother! What is them?
So that's Noah. It sounds a little bit more action film and less religious study. Is that a fair... Is that a fair comment, Karen?
Hugely action. Yes, it's also got Ray Winston and rock creatures. So what else could you ask for?
Let's talk. Now, you mentioned the sort of other thriving sort of cinema of religious pictures, the smaller scale ones. And there are a couple of movies that are doing good business at the moment, particularly the US box office. Mm-hmm. God's Not Dead is an interesting one.
Yeah.
I'll ask you about that in a second. Shall we take a little listen to that, though, first? Let's learn a little more about God's Not Dead.
There is no God. All that I require from each of you is that you fill in the papers I've just given you with three little words. God is dead. Mr. Wheaton, is something wrong?
I can't do what you want. I'm a Christian.
If you cannot bring yourself to admit that God is dead, then you will need to defend the antithesis.
Think of Jesus as my friend.
You think Jesus is God?
I don't want to disappoint him. So your acceptance of this challenge may be the only meaningful exposure to God and Jesus they'll ever have.
To me, he's not dead.
That's God's Not Dead. That sounds kind of important, Karen.
It is. Yes, very important. In fact, it's made $21 million, but it's not getting any distribution outside America, except it does have a Serbian title, so it could be showing there. But this is an example of domestic filmmaking that's getting domestic releasing, and we probably won't get to see it anywhere else.
Intriguing stuff. That's God's Not Dead. Other ones, very, very briefly, other ones to look out for. Ridley Scott, I gather, is making Exodus.
Exodus with Christian Bale.
With Batman in it, right?
Yeah, that's with Batman. Also, Heaven's for Real with Greg Kinnear. And there's also another one with Patricia Heath, Sean Astin, and country star Trace Adkins, which is called Mom's Night Out.
Well, I'm intrigued to see how that one measures up. Karen Krasanovich, our resident film expert, thank you very much for joining us here on Midori House. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24, and we're ticking towards the top of the hour. Luckily, though, there's plenty of time left. Time enough, at least, to do our daily review. Today we're talking music. I'm joined here in Studio One by Nick Luscombe. Nick, welcome back to Monocle 24.
Thank you.
And Nick, you're a, I shall say, music connoisseur. Do you like that?
I do like that.
Awesome. Well, we can work with that then. Now, people know you from Flow Motion, all these kinds of things, but you're here to tell us about some exciting new tracks, aren't you, today?
I am, yeah. I've got three tracks to play you. Shall I start with the first one?
I think that's a very, very good idea. Alice Russell, is that where we're going to begin?
Yeah, that's right. Well, Alice Russell, probably, you know, no stranger to a lot of people listening to this station. Great vocalist. She's got this track now which is going to be on Mad Men Series 7, so she's finally hit the massive time. That's a big deal.
That's probably the jackpot.
Yeah, it must be, right? Getting a sync on Mad Men. So this single features Durando, the legendary Durando, on vocals as well, and it's called Breakdown.
Let's take a little bit of a listen. This is Breakdown from Alice Russell.
Gotta get my mind clear. Away them.
So that's the sound of Breakdown from Alice Russell. You mentioned already at the top, Nick. I mean, that's a bit of a favourite, Alice Russell, of certain people here at Midori House. What do you make of that one? Up to the usual exacting standards?
I think so. She's got high standards. It's a great record. And, I mean, True Thoughts can do pretty much no wrong, in my opinion, the label that she's been working with for a long time. Mm. So, yeah, another great record. And if you haven't got any of her records already, maybe this will be the first one to go and grab.
Set you on your way.
Yeah.
So one hit so far.
Yeah.
No misses. Which is not bad, because we only had one.
It's true.
Let's see if we can keep the strike rate going. Where should we turn next? What about this one from Mo Colours? Tell me about this.
Mo Colours, yeah. So, again, this is another artist who's been sort of bubbling away, making some great singles for a while on one-handed music. And this, I think, is, again, another artist who's about to kind of, you know, shine and become a lot bigger this year. From his brand new album, which is coming out very soon on the same label. And this track is beautiful. It's very summer, which suits the kind of the mood right now.
There's definitely that feeling in the air. I want some nice summery, I want those summertime tracks that take you away from the drudgery of the winter in London.
This is definitely one of those tracks, thanks to the steel drums on it. But it's also a beautiful little tale about a little dog, which is unusual in kind of cool records, I think. So
I like the sound of this already. Let's see. So will it be the calling card for Mo Colours? Let's see. It's called Little Brown Dog, I gather. Let's take a listen. That's the sunshine sounds of Little Brown Dog from Mo Colours. Definitely still liking the steel drums. Do you think there's a bit of a tendency, though, hearing a few tracks have the kind of steel drum vibe going? Do you like it? Do you think people are just like, yeah, whack that on there, summertime, let's go for it?
No, well, not in this case, but I know what you mean. It's a kind of instant, it's a surefire way of bringing the kind of the feeling of sunshine, but I think it totally works on that record. And, the Mo Colours.
Really good stuff. We were also trying to think of quality dog-related tracks.
Yeah.
I was struggling. I advanced only Cat Stevens. Counterintuitively, of course, Cat.
Oh, yeah.
I love my dog.
Perfect.
That was about as good as we got. I don't know any other...
I Want to Be Your Dog. It's the only one I can think of.
It's not bad.
It's quite a good one.
That's one each. Making pretty good progress. Let's do it. Now, let's come up with some puns for this third track, maybe, once we've taken a listen. Tell me where we're going next. Benjamin, talk to me about this one.
All right, so I got emailed this track, and you know, which is either a good way to get through to me or a really bad way, because we get enough emails. Someone sends an actual record, that's probably a little bit more likely I'm going to listen to it.
Exactly.
But this is interesting, and I kind of thought, well, okay, let me have to listen to this. And they didn't really say much about the track. They said, oh, you might like it. And I do like it. And the reason I like it is because I really like, I'm a bit over Guilty Pleasures, but I really like Run To You by Bryan Adams, which is a record that I've got no idea what it is, but 1984 record that I just love. And I read recently...
It speaks to you. There's nothing wrong with that. There's always tracks like that.
True, isn't it? But apparently it's written for Blue Oyster Cult, which I didn't realise. And Blue Oyster Cult, Don't Fear the Reaper, is one of my favourite records of all time as well. So anyway, this record kind of reminds me of those two records. Very 80s. But the good thing is, it's from Helsinki, so, and it's modern, therefore it must be cool, right? It's just
There was no argument with that whatsoever. Yeah. Should we take a listen?
Yeah.
That was a dose of pure, undiluted 80s pleasure
right there.
I was having to roll up my shirt and jacket sleeves just to even think about listening to that
Completely,
one.
Completely, yeah.
Pretty good stuff.
Good, isn't it? 2014, that sounding a little bit older though, right?
Only by, just about 20 odd years. Now, tell us, Nick, it was interesting you made that point there about getting sent records. How does that work? You must just get deluged with tracks, records, emails. Is it always pleasurable, or do you kind of dread the things that you're going to be sent? Or is there always little gems in there somewhere?
Yeah, there's always. I mean, it's just, I don't know. I think there's just more music being made now than ever, and the more ways to access it, you know. So, no, I'm still excited about it. Every time something drops through a letterbox or an email, you know, I genuinely am. So it's...
that's good stuff. That's good. And tell us, Nate, our sort of regular listeners of Monocle 24 will know about Musicity and some of your various other projects. Tell us, how's that all going? What's in store for the next kind of few months? Lots of exciting things.
Yeah, Musicity's relaunching in Singapore at the end of this month, end of April, in a different district this time. So it's the kind of low-rise side of Singapore, the sort of slightly hidden away aspects. And we've got lots of spoken word poets and local musicians working there. And a big series of events, ticketed events as well. So that's been the big thing for Musicity. And then we're talking to other people in other cities, as always. You know, so hopefully more places will open up this year.
All around the world.
Yeah.
Watch out. Musicity is coming. Nick Luscombe will be there as well. Nick, thanks very much, as always, for joining us here on Monocle 24.
Thank you.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Das ist Monocle 24.
Hong Kong,
Zurich,
London.
This is Monocle 24.
And that is all we have time for on today's edition of Midori House. My thanks in particular to our special guests, Jeffrey Kaufman and Samira Shackle, and of course also to Karen Krasanovic and Nick Luscombe. Today's show was produced by Marco Zippi, researched by Alexa Firmanich and Janie Cho, and our studio manager was Alex Funnell. Next after the headlines is Section D. We'll speak to artistic heavyweight Anish Kapoor and meet Mark Henderson, co-founder of a leading initiative that's helping to elevate the status and line the pockets of craftsmen across the British Isles.
Somebody stood up and said, the problem with the luxury goods industry is it's hijacked the craft industry. And I thought, no, stupid. That's entirely wrong. It's just the craft industry is terrible at marketing itself.
More of that next. Then at 2200 hours, you've got the Monocle Daily with Emma Nelson and Andrew Muller. This show will be back at the same time tomorrow. That's 1800 here in London. But for this edition of Midori House, it's goodbye and thanks for tuning in.
The Rolex Mentor and Protégé Arts Initiative sources young artists and brings them together with artistic masters for a year of mentoring. For mentors, it's a year to share their passion and expertise. For protégés, it's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to observe and work alongside some of the world's greatest artists. 1 year can inspire a lifetime. Rolex.